The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Free Library. My name's Elliot Shelcrutt. I'm president of the library. And it's my pleasure to introduce Ann Patchett. Before we get started, I have to remind you and myself, let's turn off our cell phones. You'd think I would have thought of that before. And, of course, as usual, there will be a book signing upstairs immediately after the program. A little bit of news about the library. About 2 weeks ago, we became a wireless entity in every single one of our libraries all over the city. And we're very proud of that. You can download videos as well as audio books and other things from our website, which our website we've made, or you can use our old website. Our new domain name makes it easier for you. It's freelibrary.org, which is a lot easier. And the other thing I'd like to tell you about, please come back sometime in the afternoon or the morning during daylight, right above the stairs in the lobby. A skylight, which has been closed off and sealed since World War II, has now been opened, along with the brand new roof on this building, which was just completed. And it makes a remarkable difference in that stairwell. Of course, now it also, part of the difference is you realize how dirty the walls are, but we'll get to that too. But at any rate, it's really quite amazing and lovely to see the light streaming in. Ann Patchett was raised in Nashville, Tennessee, and studied creative writing at Sarah Lawrence College, and published her first story in the Paris Review at age 21. The New York Times has advised readers to expect miracles when they read Ann Patchett's fiction. Her first novel, Patron Saint of Liars, tells the story of a young woman who flees her marriage to find a new family at a Catholic home for unwed mothers. Her second novel, Taft, centers on the Memphis Blues Bar and a black middle-aged bartender. In The Magician's Assistant, a gay magician's death becomes the catalyst for his partner's journey of self-discovery. And Bel Canto spins a tale of love and opera in the midst of an extended terrorist takeover at a party at a South American embassy. One of the most interesting and unconventional writers of her generation, Patchett's power lies in her unusual ability to make believable the voices of a sweeping array of characters. The recipient of the Penn Faulkner Award and the Orange Prize for Fiction, Ms. Patchett has also written for numerous publications, Atlantic Monthly, New York Times Magazine, Washington Post, and in 2004, Ann Patchett published her best-selling memoir, Truth and Beauty, chronicling her friendship with author Lucy Greeley. Her latest novel, Run, is set over a period of 24 hours and takes readers on a suspenseful journey through one day that changes everything for a Boston family. We are honored to have her here this evening. Please join me in welcoming Ann Patchett. Ann?
Hello. The last time I was here with my pal Ward Just, and I'm missing Ward Just tonight. If anybody wants to be in the role of Ward Just, just so we can get this off the table and move on with our evening, I am sorry about your team. It's hard to know what is worse. I can't tell you how many times in my life I have been in competition with some sporting event where I show up and they're like, sorry, there are only four people here, but it's the playoffs. And I always think, is it better if they lose, then you're going to stay home and be depressed? Or is it better if they win, then you're going to go out and get drunk? But I'm pleased to see that you were able to work through your sorrows and come out this evening. I really appreciate it. It's a beautiful night. And I'm always glad to be in Philadelphia, and I'm always glad to be in a library. I am very involved with my library at home in Nashville, and I feel very strongly that libraries are one of the things in this country, and there are many things in this country that are working really well, but libraries are one of them, because libraries are a source of real equality. And when I look at our healthcare system and our education system and our criminal justice system, I would like to see things working more on the library's model. Because the fact is that anyone can get exactly the book that they need. Those books are available equally to every person in every library. If your library doesn't have the book, they will get that book for you no matter what it is. And when I think about that compared to public school systems and healthcare systems, you know, where there's an incredible inequity of service from one building to the next, what is so great about libraries is that they are open, they are free to all, and that anyone can get any book no matter how tiny the library is. So I'm very glad that you're here and that we're all supporting our library. I'm on book tour. I've been on book tour since 1992, which is when The Patron Saint of Liars came out. And book tour has really changed. And this is not going to be the evening of how hard life is for me. But I do want to say it is really different. There was a piece in my local paper that my mom called and read to me over the phone a couple of days ago. It was written by a columnist for the Tennessean, and she said the first time, it was not somebody I remembered meeting, but she said the first time she ever met me was in 1992 at a Tennessean book and author dinner. And there were four people at the dinner that night, and they signed, they had a sign before the dinner. That's always a huge mistake. Never sign before you speak, because I'm good at this and people will be more interested, but they had obviously never heard of me because it was like the first week of my first book. And the three other writers on the panel were Janet Daly. Janet Daly, if you don't know who Janet Daly in 1992 was Nora Roberts. And then she got caught up in some unfortunate plagiarism thing, and that was that. A guy named Ricky Van Shelton, who was a big country star in Nashville, who wrote a book called A Duck Called Quackers, and Jimmy Buffett. And so not only were there four of us at a table, three of the people had lines that went back to Memphis. Half the people in the room had baseball caps with parrots on them. I had no clue what that was about. That was a little distressing. And what this woman wrote this article about was that Frank Sutherland, who was then and now the editor of the Tennessean, felt so sorry for me because no one was in my line that he went out and bought 25 copies of Patron Saint of Liars and randomly gave them to people to come and get in my line and have me sign them. And that I never knew that. I thought that I had this like sudden spontaneous burst of popularity. Up until the point at which Frank bought 25 copies of my book, I had one person in my line, and it was a teenage boy who had a camera. And this also an experience I had never had before, but I've had since. And the kid came up, and he said to somebody in the Jimmy Buffett line, could you take my picture with her. Was that all right? Can I have my picture taken with you? Oh, sure. You know, that's fine. And I come around the table and the kid puts his arm around me and we smile and somebody from the Jimmy Buffett line takes our picture and gives the kid's camera back. And I said, well, why? Just curious. Why do you want a picture of me? And he said, because I'm going to go back to school and tell everybody you're my girlfriend. Back in those days, I did somewhere between 25 and 30 cities in a car. And I have to tell you, New York publicists all failed U.S. geography in seventh grade. My budget was $3,000. I slept in a truck stop every night. I ate in truck stops three meals a day. I got really fat on that book tour. I had potatoes for breakfast. I had the little home fries for breakfast. I had the French fries for lunch and the mashed potatoes for dinner, three meals a day. And the way it would work is I had a dress. I had one dress that I kept out flat in the trunk of my car, and I would drive to Indianapolis. And then I would go to McDonald's, and I would go to the bathroom, and I would put the dress on, and I would go to the bookstore, and there would be no one there. I don't know about you. Have you ever gone to the reading of a first novelist you've never heard of before who didn't get any reviews? I never have. And so book tour was the process by which you made nice to the girl at the cash register. And honestly, that was the tour. Usually she was getting married, and so you would go and get a bridal magazine. I fortunately wrote for Bridal Guide at those days, so I had some street cred. And you would spend 2 hours standing at the cash register talking about her bridesmaids' dresses. And then you would leave. I would leave. I would go back to McDonald's. I would take my dress off. I would put it in the trunk. And I would drive until 2 o'clock in the morning because, you know, my next show was in Little Rock, Arkansas. And I would sleep at the truck stop and get up and drive some more so I could make it to the bookstore on time, so I could change clothes, so I could meet the next girl at the next cash register. And I did that for 30 cities. But, you know, I really believe there was something to it. Like, I was really nice to those girls. I really listened to them. Like Hillary Clinton, it was my listening tour, you know? And they remembered me, and therefore they read my book. And they would recommend the book to the four people who happened to come into that store. What happens is you always tour for your last book. So nobody comes to your first tour. Your second tour, which was my tour for Taft, the people who read Patron Saint of Liars came. My third tour, the third tour was Magician's Assistant, so the people who read Patron Saint of Liars and Taft came. The Bel Canto tour was really interesting. That was the Magician's Assistant people tour. The Magician's Assistant people, because my fan base is broken into very clear groups, the Magician's Assistant people are my deepest people. And they all came into the store with their copies of Magician's Assistant, and they would stand in line. And, you know, it was a good tour, the Bel Canto tour, but maybe, I don't know, like 30 people a night, way up from 3. You know, it was a huge step up for me to get 30 people. But they were 30 people who all cried. And they had the book, and they would get up to me in line, and they would say, I read this book. I'm not mocking. I know it sounds like I'm mocking. It's sort of touching and horrifying in combination night after night. And they would start to cry because someone they loved had died and they got this book and it really resonated with them. And I would get up from the table and I would go around and I would put my arms around them and I would cry and then we'd get them settled down. And then the next person would come up in line and they would say, I swore I wasn't going to do this. The sentence I heard most often on that book tour, I swore I wasn't going to do this. And then they did. So that was Bel Canto. So I didn't tour for Truth and Beauty. I have no problems with Truth and Beauty. It's not like I object to talking about my friend. I don't get upset about it. But I didn't want to do it on a book tour. You know, I didn't want to do it every single night. And that means that this book tour is the Bel Canto Truth and Beauty book tour, which means I'm in trouble. And it's, you know, it's great. It's really great, but it's really, really different. And I'm reminded very much suddenly of patron saint of liars and driving around and sort of thinking about the old days. And I guess they were the bad old days. And it's just always different. It's not exactly better and it's not exactly worse, but it's really, really different. So now I have yet another book that nobody will really know anything about until I write another book. And then all the Run people will come to me. And then I'll get to sort of assess the character of the Run audience. And that'll be its own thing. I'm going to read a little bit. This is kind of from the end of the book, but it's a scene that doesn't have anything to do with the book, so it doesn't make any difference. I remember one of the first times I read from Patron Saint of Liars, I thought it was incredible. It was at a conference, a writer's conference or something. I thought it was incredibly important that you understood everything about the book, and you would never be able to follow what I was talking about. So I got there early, and there was a blackboard in the room, and I spent an hour writing out all the characters' names and their connections, and this is how we get to this scene, and this is what it means, and this is the significance. And now I'm like, hey, here I am. I'm reading from my book. You get it or you don't. So the long and the short of it is there are some characters, the Doyles. They're going to a Jesse Jackson lecture. There is an accident, and they get stuck with an 11-year-old girl named Kenya. The book takes place in 24 hours, and the next day, Tip, who is one of the sons who studies ichthyology at Harvard, the science of fish. I didn't know it either. It took me a long time to learn how to spell it. And Kenya and Tip have gone to the fish lab. Tip has a sprained ankle. It's snowing. Tip's not feeling so well. They're on their way to the hospital to see Kenya's mother, who is about to get out of surgery. On the way, they stop at the Gordon Track at Harvard so she can go run, because the name of the book is Run. And that's what Kenya loves to do, and it's what she kind of needs to do to blow off some steam. The girl at the front desk doesn't want to let her in because Kenya's not a student, because she is 11. And if any of you have ever had anything to do with Harvard, you know they take these things very seriously. This is also the book tour of Anne's failing eyesight. I'm almost 44, and everyone said it would happen, like 40 or 43, early 40, like one day. And it happened for me right in the middle of reading Sophie's Choice. I can't tell you how much I hate that book. I can tell you why I hate it for many reasons, but mainly because I believe it robbed me of my eyesight. I read Joan Didion's fantastic book, The Year of Magical Thinking, and there was a line in that book in which she said, "It was the summer that John Gregory stood in the pool reading Sophie's Choice over and over again, trying to figure out how he did it." And I thought, well, that's reason enough for me to read Sophie's Choice. Did you guys read Sophie's Choice? It's like the best book I ever read for the first 250 pages, and then it becomes this monumental train wreck. And I was very angry about it. And I haven't gotten used to the whole nausea thing of tilting my head up and down. So they get past the girl in the front desk. "You better run fast," Tip said to Kenya when he finally caught up with her. "I've put myself on the line for you." Kenya was looking up to the banners hanging from the ceiling, Princeton and Columbia and Yale. She was looking down at the wide sweep of red track, so thick and soft she would spring halfway to the rafters with every strike. "Oh, I do." There was a yellow-haired boy doing high step and lunge in the straight sprint lanes that lay in the center of the track, two girls doing easy laps on the inside lanes, a third girl by herself running fast with a strong kickback. The rest of the track was empty, And for a minute, she wanted to go back to the girl at the desk and tell her, in case she didn't know, that only 4 people were actually using the facilities when there was enough space for every kid in her grade and the grade ahead of her, plus all the teachers to run full on without bumping into one another. Just who did the guardian at the gate think she was saving it for? Tip sat down on the front bleacher, put his crutches on the floor. "Put your foot up," Kenya said, taking off her coat and hat and scarf. "When do the Girl Scouts get to be so bossy?" he said, but he put his leg up. She wasn't listening to him anymore. She was hopping up and down now, a manic pink spring, ready to spend the ounce of herself that she had been holding on to tight, tight, tight. She put her hands on the ground and she tried to make herself stretch, but she didn't think that she had the time. She felt certain that if she waited another minute, she was going to explode and it would all come raining down on her. And the last thing that she wanted to be was the girl who was crying on the Gordon track. That would get her thrown out for sure. She stood up and for an instant went on her toes, and then at the crack of the gun that she kept in her head, she was gone. She kept it light at first, swinging past the gently jogging girls who were locked in their own breathless conversation. "And so I told him." Past the curve of the high step, lunging boy who kept his legs so even and straight he resembled a mechanical doll. If there had been endless time, she might have gone over and joined him, but the need to run was so strong now, she had to fight to hold herself back, to keep herself from tearing out chunks of the soft red track with her heels. She needed to take it slow at first, to stretch down through her toes, to pump her elbows up behind her. The cold had settled into her bones, she felt it now. The cold from the high bedroom where she had slept the night before, and the cold that had built up in her skin even before that, crouching down in the snow beside her mother, holding her mother's cold hand. She had absorbed her mother's cold into her, and it had worked a frost along the inside of her veins. It had been cold in the hospital, in the little room where they hooked her mother up to the monitors while she slept. There hadn't been time to think about it then, how cold she was, how her hands ached, how her head was splitting from the ice that had built up inside her ears. It was cold in the hospital waiting room with Teddy talking about the snow, and it was cold at the piano, though she had loved to play. It was cold in the kitchen and cold when she went back to her own apartment. It was every bit as cold there as it was outside. It was unbearably cold. Without her mother to wrap her in a blanket and fix her a cup of chocolate and talk about how the sun poured over everything in Kenya, the place for which she was the namesake, where they agreed they would go together someday. In Kenya, it was hot enough to make you forget that winter ever existed. And this morning, well, she had been freezing every minute of it. Her coat wasn't half as warm as Tip's, and even though she'd brought a sweater from home, she hadn't been able to wear it under her coat because then the coat was too tight to get her arms through the sleeves. Tip was on crutches. She didn't blame him, but he practically moved like the hands on a clock, and she was having to nail her feet to the sidewalk to keep from running over him every step. She was picking up her pace on the track, but not to where she would take it. She could have run this fast in the snow. She let herself float forward, every step a leap, her legs stretching out like scissors open wide. She was a swimmer, a gymnastics star. She was a superhuman force that sat outside the fundamental law of nature. Gravity did not apply to her. "Meditation in motion," her coach would say. She heard his voice in her head as she lapped the talking girls, as she swept past the one who was there to run. From the corner of her vision, she could see the step lunge boy stand up straight and watch her pass. She dried off his forehead with a breeze that she made. She wasn't racing anything but the sight of her mother being hit by a car. That, and she raced the Doyles at their breakfast table, saying that she lived too close, and the girl at the front desk intimating that Kenya was not a person to be on this track any more than she should have a house on Dartmouth Street. She was racing Thoreau and his jar of fish because he continued to hound her. How was she supposed to know who Thoreau was? It was her plan to outrun all of that, and somewhere in the running, she had started to fly. She no longer felt like touching all the dirt and the muck she had so patiently submitted herself to so that people would think that she was a very nice girl. Well, she was not such a very nice girl. Nobody who was very, very nice would ever work this hard to take something that they wanted only for themselves. Nice girls did not demand that everyone stop what they were doing and look at them, but that's exactly what she asked for, and it's what she got. All the other runners on the track had stopped now, the way dancers will stop when a soloist steps forward to dominate the floor. The girl from the front desk was there, too. Kenya caught sight of her extraordinary hair. She blew past. Tip was there, his leg off the bench now and straight out in front, as though he thought at any moment he might have to throw a rope around her and pull her back. Anger and sadness and a sense of injustice that was bigger than any one thing that had happened stoked an enormous fire in her chest, and that fire kept her heart vibrant and hot and alive, a beautiful, infallible machine. They were no longer waiting to see how fast she could go, or they knew how fast she could go. Now they were waiting to see how long it would be before she crashed. And if that's what they were waiting for, well, they might as well sit back and get comfortable. Tip had never seen anything like it. Not just the speed, but the utter effortlessness of it all. The way the toes of her shoes barely touched down before she set off again. She was a sprinter, clearly. She was a sprinter, and yet she just kept going until he started to change his mind and wonder if she wasn't going to knock out half a marathon on the track while he sat there waiting. "You weren't kidding about her," the girl from the front desk said. Tip didn't know how long she had been sitting on the bleachers there next to him, but he couldn't turn his face towards her. "No," he said. "Are you a runner too? Did you hurt your foot running?" "I don't run," he said. "Something like that," she shook her head. "You'd think it would have to be genetic." "Maybe it is," he said, watching her shoot past them again. Kenya's hands were open. Her face was easy and relaxed. She made none of those huffing sounds that would indicate the seriousness of her endeavor. "Maybe I should give it another try." They were silent through the next lap and the next. "I'm going to call the coach so he can come over and see this," the dark-haired girl said, because the runner had still not flagged, and really, if anything, she was getting stronger. "Not today," Tip said. He kept his eyes on Kenya every second. He felt like he was seeing greatness, like he was in the room watching Watson and Crick put the final touches on their model of DNA. Or maybe he was seeing Rosalind Franklin with her magnificent X-rays. Wasn't it the girl, after all, who actually found the key to life? Kenya was a flame, a thin pink wick. "We've got some place we have to be in a little while." "Well, somebody needs to see this," she said. "She's only 11. "Well, she won't stay 11. There was part of Tip that wanted to engage this girl, to flirt with her, but he couldn't turn his head. What would it be like to know at 11 the great thing that you could do? This is what Doyle had always wanted from them, what Father Sullivan had wanted, a mission, a calling. Tip thought that he had found one in the fishes, but it was nothing like this. Kenya's running was pure ability, strength, grace, concentration, and the odd thing was that Tip believed her skill must be transferable. It wasn't just that he was watching her run, he was watching who she was. It seemed perfectly reasonable to think that she could take this energy and pour it into anything. It was not too long after that that the little bird started to land. Her leaps coming back to a trot, her trot smoothing out to a jog. The black-haired girl began to whistle and clap, and the other runners who had been pressed to the sidewall by Kenya's centrifugal force clapped as well. Tip clapped for her, and she waved her hand while keeping her eyes straight ahead. The blonde boy came up and started walking beside her, and they talked back and forth, something Tip couldn't hear. The little girl from the Cathedral Projects and the Harvard boy, they were talking about what? Training techniques? She said something that made him laugh, and he patted her on the shoulder and ran off at a modest pace while Kenya rounded her last turn. The three girls came up from the bench and shook her hand, and then she headed back. "You're something, kid," the front desk girl said to her. "Thanks," she said, and took a giant inhale, "for letting me in." Tip shook his head. "Secretariat." "Who?" "It's a horse. It's a very fast horse." Kenya nodded, taking long, deep breaths. "People say that to me, not that horse, some other horse." Okay, that's the little reading. Thank you. I'm going to tell you one story, and then we'll answer questions. I didn't know, I mean, this is the abbreviated story, the abbreviated version, or as my husband would say in his Mississippi way, to make a long story short, which I always say is the entree to, I'm going to make this as long as possible. When I wrote Bel Canto, I didn't know anything about opera, and I made a decision. It was a story that was on the news, and I wanted to write about it, a version of it. I wanted a woman. I wanted an artist. I decided that artist should be an opera singer, and so I set about to learn opera. And I did this in a lot of ways, mostly through a book that I found called Opera 101 by Fred Plotkin, also a teaching company course, How to Listen to and Love Opera, 22 hours. I started spending all of my disposable income going to opera. I became obsessed. I became the Catholic convert of operas, the boring person who isn't gracious, who traps other people at cocktail parties and talks about opera, because I was, I don't know, I was in my early 30s before I had ever listened to an opera before. I knew nothing about music. And when the book was done, about 30 people sent it to Renee Fleming because they thought it was a book about her. It was not a book about her, even though I myself have said that it is a book about her, because it practically is at this point. Everywhere I go, that's what I read. It's a book about her. I completely believe it. Renee called me. We had lunch. We actually became like great girlfriends. We traveled together. We, you know, all of a sudden, I am totally in this opera world. And in to the extent that at the New York Times for a while I was opera girl. And if anything happened in the world of opera, they would say, well, you know, call opera girl. We'll have to get her opinion on this. And so when I'm totally blanking on his name. Just Pavarotti, thank you very much. I was thinking fat, P. I got up really early this morning. When Pavarotti canceled his Tosca at the Met, they called me, you know, to write my seminal opinion on what this meant culturally to opera, because I was the voice of American opera. I started going places with Renee. You know, she would call, hey, I'm in Houston. I've got a big suite. Come on, see Traviata tonight. Okay. And at one point, I get to go to the Met for a Traviata at the Met, and I get to go backstage during the performance. Now, going backstage during performance of the Met is an honor that is reserved exclusively for the mistresses of the tenors. And this is true, okay? Not the wives, not the children. The tenors' mistresses are the only ones allowed backstage during a performance. The tenors' mistresses and opera girl. Because everyone is so abuzz that the person who really understands opera, because she read a book called Opera 101. And I'm there. And at every curtain call, the stage manager says, go on, opera girl. You can pull the curtain back. And so I get to take the curtain and I roll myself in it. While oh, I almost fell off the back of it. That would have been great. While Renee goes out to take her bows between acts. And then the fourth act comes along, and Violetta is in bed, waiting, and it's dark, and I'm standing there, and Renee says, "Come on. Come on, get in bed." And I get in bed with Renee Fleming in the fourth act of La Traviata. And we sit there in the dark, and we wait until the stage manager comes out and says, very politely, lifting the covers, "Opera girl, come on." And I get out of bed, and I go, and I wait. It's bizarre. But this is the way fiction is. If it's fiction, you're writing about things you don't know. You're writing about people who aren't you. You're writing from your heart. You're writing from the things that you care about. But people say to me all the time, well, you must be a singer. You must play the piano. You must be a magician. You must have been a pregnant girl in a home for unwed mothers. And my very favorite, you must have had shingles, because no one could write about shingles unless they... I make it up. That's what I do. And I do it with authority, right? That's... You stand up, you put your shoulders back, you say, yeah, New York Times, I'm opera girl. You want to know the story? You come to me. That's what being a novelist is about. But what is amazing, and what I didn't know, is actually it's not so much that your life affects the book, but the book affects your life. And the book affects other people's lives. So that the greatest thing that's happened is I've had so many people come up to me and say, I never listened to opera until I read this book. I thought opera was too hard for me. I understood the beauty of opera for the first time when I read this book, and now I go to the opera. I love the opera. By the way, I know that you live in a civilized American city, but from those of us in the provinces, let me tell you the best thing that has happened in my life. MetOpera.org, met at the movies. I saw 6 operas from the Metropolitan Theater. Yeah. At my hometown Green Hills Theater, and I will get to see 8 operas this year starting December 15th. That's huge. There are people going to those operas because they read Bel Canto. So it occurs to me, why not write a book about decent people who believe in leadership? Why not write a book... about social responsibility, in which parents say to their children, you are smart, kind, privileged. Is it enough to study fish, or do you actually have some responsibility to your community outside your own desires? Is it possible that family values apply to people who don't actually share our DNA? Not just the people that we adopt and bring into our family, but the people we don't want. We're responsible for them, too. And a lot of the flack at this book, whew, I'm getting such great reviews and such hideous reviews, as you in Philadelphia know. But the big rap that I'm getting is that I'm too nice, and it's so unrealistic because I'm writing about nice people. I don't know about you, but I actually personally know a lot of very decent people. It doesn't mean that there's no conflict, but... I'm a little chip in a big mosaic, and I believe that all of the other kinds of people are very well represented. And I have seen through my experience that art actually can shape a landscape. Fiction is so important. There are so many people who say, I don't read fiction because I don't like things that aren't true. Fiction is a compassionate act, both as a writer and a reader, is the act of imagining other people's lives. And that is what we must do. We must think outside our own selves into the minds of other people, because it is the only way, in the words of Rodney King, that we're all just going to get along. So I would love to answer questions. I'll stop preaching to the choir. You know, the library audience, it's like shooting fish in a barrel, really. yes. Oh, wait, we're doing this with microphones. Ma'am, there, in the center of the room. Do you want to point? I jumped my gun here. Okay, all right. I'm not a trained professional.
Neither am I. Let's see. I'd like to ask you a question that refers to truth and beauty.
Yes, please.
Your beautiful memoir about your friend Lucy Greeley, and it's about Lucy, 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 Lucy. Like a lot of readers, after I finished it, I ran to read Autobiography of a Face, which is about Lucy, 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 Lucy. Never a word about Anne. And I wonder what your reaction to that was, and what is that about? You were such an important part of her support system. Why was there no Anne in Autobiography of a Face?
Because I'd actually never met her, and I made the whole thing up.
Autobiography of a Face is largely a book about a time before I knew Lucy. And it really ends not that far after college, and we weren't close until later. I mean, there definitely is an overlap. There is a part of that book that I still exist in. In the same way that that book is dedicated to my friends whom I love, I think that Lucy was very worried about naming anyone. And there are very few people named in that book. She didn't want to single people out. It also is about a very personal, claustrophobic, lonely journey. And a story about how alone she felt no matter how many people were around her. So I don't know anybody who felt slighted by that. I always said to her, when she was dedicating that book, I kept saying, you're wasting it. Nobody will feel like it's for them. You should pick somebody. And she really couldn't. I mean, that was a book about her loneliness, and it makes sense that there weren't a lot of people in there. That doesn't mean that there weren't a lot of people there. So, sure. Yes.
Can you talk about how you decided to use the snow in Run? Because I feel like it's really beautiful, but I'd just like to hear about, did you always know that it was going to be in the snow?
Do you know, I'm trying to think. It's such a funny process because I knew that that accident was going to be in the snow. I knew that the first moment was going to be in the snow. But I thought that the book was actually going to take place over about a month when I started it. So I didn't think it was going to be totally snowbound. When I got to about page 136 and I was 6 hours into the book, I figured either this is going to be an 8-volume novel or I need to actually collapse my time structure and make it happen in a day. So I think that that's the answer, that I knew that that first night and a car accident would be tied up in snow. I didn't think the whole book would be, but it was a time thing. And, hey, snow, wouldn't that have been a nice title for the book? Yes, in the back. This is like a tennis match for you.
And I had listened to an interview you did with Borders Bookstore, and you had talked about how the Magic Mountain really affected your writing. And I was wondering if there were other authors who have influenced you throughout your writing.
You know, I really believe that for me, I don't know if this is true for most people, but I bet it is true for a lot of people, there's a time that you can be influenced. And it's not so much that someone comes along and influences you because they're so great or true or this is the moment. It is the moment that you read something, the moment that you meet someone. I mean, the teachers that I had who were so important to me were teachers that I had at a moment in my life that I was open to being taught. I read The Magic Mountain when I was 16. You know, it just blew the top of my head off. And the people who really were influential to me were the people that I read in high school. And the serious novels that I read in high school were the books that my parents were reading that were around the house. Philip Roth, John Updike, Saul Bellow. Those were the people who really taught me how to write a novel because that was the time that I was really looking for lessons. There are people that I love. You know, people always say, who influenced you? That's not necessarily who I feel passionately about. I am on an enormous Henry James drag that I've been on for the last 2 years. I cannot think of a less Jamesian writer than myself. I wish Henry James could influence me, but it can't. But I love it. Sometimes I love something so much because it's something that I could never do. Nabokov, Garcia Marquez, and I look at these people with just complete wonder because I could never get to that place. If I had read them if only my parents had been reading Garcia Marquez at a time that it could have really helped me. Why weren't they? Yes.
I have several questions.
Let's take them one at a time.
Okay. How... First, I hate the fact you're so young, but that's okay. You've done so much. It's such an accomplishment. How did you decide you were a writer? How did you decide this, what you wanted to do?
First question?
Okay.
That's very nice that you say that I'm so young, because that's another thing I think about a lot on book tour. Because book tour has always been about ingenue Anne. And it used to be when I went to a bookstore for Patron Saint, when I really was young, I mean, when I was 27, and people would just, and I looked 16, and people would flip when I came into the store, and everything was about how I looked and how young I was. And now people hardly ever say that to me anymore. And so that's very nice. I was somebody who knew absolutely from day one, from the time anyone ever said to me, "What do you want to be?" "I want to be a writer." When I was 5, I would have told you that. Now, it's interesting because I didn't actually learn how to read and write probably until I was in the 3rd grade. We moved around a lot, and I just didn't go to school that often. And I think sometimes, I wonder now if saying, "I want to be a writer," actually meant I want to be able to write. And that those things got conflated in my mind. Okay, that's question number one.
Where did the idea for this book come from? Bel Canto obviously was based on things that were happening in the real world.
It came from two places. One, when I was 19 years old, I did summer school at Harvard, and I met a boy who studied ichthyology at Harvard. And I have all my life been blown away by the idea that someone, he really is, I mean, probably one of the smartest people I've ever known in my life, and we're still good friends, that he studied fish and then went on to Stanford and got a degree in lepidoptery and evolutionary biology and then became a lawyer. It was tragic. But he's really rich now. And so I've always wanted to write about that, someone studying lepidoptery, ichthyology. And then when I was writing Bel Canto, I started thinking about this book. I started thinking about the idea of a father trying to raise a son to be a leader. And I was asking myself, okay, if you wanted to raise a son to be a leader, one son, great leadership, what would you raise them to be? And at first I really thought a scientist. A scientist has a better shot at saving the world at this point than anyone else. Then I thought, no. And when I changed my mind, we're talking about over the course of like a year, then I thought about religion. Maybe a great religious leader who could really unite people would come forth. And then I thought ultimately, realistically, a politician would be the person who could actually make a difference. And in that thought process, finally arrived at this story over a very, very long period of time.
And I won't hog the mic, but one last question.
Okay.
Did the two boys have to be African American?
They didn't have to be African American, no, but they were, you know. Part of that was, I mean, I guess I could have made them a couple of Korean girls, but I just wanted, it to be clear that it was, they were adopted. This was not a story about finding out that you were adopted. This was a story about knowing from day one you were adopted. This is also a story about people who wanted more children, not a particular brand of child, but a child. And those are the children that they love, the ones that they got. Someone so far in the back, time for your workout. All the way back. I always feel like singing the Jeopardy song in these moments.
Yeah. Hi.
And
by coincidence, my book club meeting this month is your first book. And so first I wanted to invite you to come participate.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Thank you.
I think that would make the coolest book club ever. But that said, I had a feeling you probably were going on to more cities. So I wanted to ask you, you know, you were my age when you wrote that book, as are many of the women in my book club. So I wondered, if you were at the book club, what would you have to say to us about that book?
I would say I have not read that book since 1992, and I do not know what it is about. A couple of years ago, I was speaking at Miss Porter's school in Connecticut, and the woman who introduced me did this beautiful, elaborate, it was like her dissertation on Patchett, and she read a long section. It was just a descriptive section out of The Patron Saint of Liars. News to me. I kept thinking, oh, that's good. That's pretty. Oh, wow. When this was made into a CBS Monday Night Movie of the Week, shown every 15 minutes on Lifetime Television for Women, and available through Netflix, I went to the filming, and this was a really long time ago. I mean, 8, 10 years ago. I can't even remember. And even then, the girls with the big rubber tummies were coming up and saying, I want to know more about the motivation of my character. And I'd be like, what I can tell you is that Rose goes to Taft. The character of Rose has a little part in my second book, Taft. So if you wonder where she ends up, that's where she goes. I am sorry to be so... The idea of a patron saint book club makes my heart cold. And I have friends. My friend Erica, who's with me tonight, that's her favorite book of mine. Not her favorite book, but her favorite book of mine. And I'm always thinking, wow, woo, how, you know, and I don't know, maybe it's good. I can't imagine that it's good, but maybe it's good. Yes.
Of all the characters you've created, which is your favorite?
Gen.
Of all the characters you have created, did you answer?
the translator, Gen, in Bel Canto. Oh. But actually, that was like a great routine. You did that seamlessly. Gen is the person I would most like to be. Because he's like a superhero. He has the skill. I have no other languages. I weep when I have to order something in a restaurant in Italy. You know, so that would be my dream to begin. And so I love him. But I never think about him anymore. Because I'm like a turtle who lays her eggs in the sand and crawls on.
You are very, very funny.
Thank you.
Have you ever thought about writing humor?
You know, this is such a very poignant moment thing in my life, a conversation that my husband and I have all the time, because my husband doesn't think I'm funny. And I love him. We have such a happy marriage. I mean, everything is good, but we constantly are having this conversation. And part of it has to do with the fact that I really am moderate to low funny in normal life. But I am really funny if I have a microphone. And I think it is, it's about performance. You know, I don't come up here as me. You know, I'm actually really dull. And I have to kind of put, you know, ha, 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 ha. It's really true. My best friend Erica is sitting in the front row. I could bring her up to attest to the fact that I am, in fact, you know, I'm a really happy person with lots of friends and a good family and a good marriage and a stable life and no medical problems and, you know, things are smooth. And whenever newspapers call my publicist and they say, we want to profile her, but we have to find the edge, which means when did she kick heroin or did she get that murder expunged from her record since she was only 14 or, you know, that sort of thing. The edge means either something bad or I collect tin cans, you know? So I have to put something on when I do this. And what I tend to put on is funny. And I probably could actually, well, you know what? I don't know. I did a show a few weeks ago for, this was a Renee thing, the National Symphony Orchestra had the opening of their season, and they wanted me to come up and give a talk, Opera Girl, about opera to the Board of Trustees, to their billion-dollar people. And so there was a very fancy lunch, and I was the luncheon speaker. And when I say billion-dollar people, I don't mean that metaphorically. And of the people in the room, I think that there were only three people who had ever heard of me before. It's been a long time since I have given a talk to a group of people who had not one clue who I was, what I did, why I was in the room. They weren't people who were interested in my kind of book. It was tough. And they were not as inclined to laugh. And so there's a whole audience dynamic. When somebody comes to see you, and, you know, you're hoping that it's good, right? Because a lot of writers actually write fantastic books, and they're like just watching a pet rock at the podium. And so part of your laughter is just relief that I don't stink, you know? And when these billionaires were sitting there, and I was just thinking, oh, I'm dying up here. But they all got a signed Bel Canto at the end, and they all came up and patted my hand and said, oh, we're going home to read your book. We like you. They didn't like me enough to laugh, so... How are we doing? I can stay here all night, but I will also say it's very hot in here, so I'm worried about you suffering. Okay. Two more questions or peace, either one. Yes. I never know if it's hot in here because I'm under the Easy Bake oven lights or...
Thanks. I wonder if you could talk about the creative process for a little bit. I remember in Truth and Beauty you spoke about the writing of the patron saint of liars and how it all kind of came to you while you were working as a waitress and it just wrote itself while you were separating silverware or something. So anyway, I'd like to hear about that.
I didn't say that. I'll tell you about the creative process. It's work. And so many writers will come and say, I created these characters, and then they just took off, and I was typing as fast as I could behind them, and they were just hijacking my story, and I couldn't believe all the amazing things they were doing, and it was like I wasn't even in the room. I was just channeling, blah, 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 blah. And I think, bull. It's a job. And anybody who waits for the muse might write a really great six-line poem every 5 years, but they have never written a novel. Writing a novel is like swimming to Cuba. You know, you just keep going, plodding along day after day after day. I am not regular. There are a lot of days I don't write. I write very little at the beginning. I write a whole lot at the end. I get fat, I'm like the horse that sees the barn. The farther I go, the faster I get. But I always think, you know, if you had a brain tumor and you went to a surgeon and that surgeon said to you, I cut off the top of your head and I start to put my scalpel into your brain. And then, I don't know, something just takes over my hands. And it's like I'm not even there, but I'm cutting and I'm cutting and I'm cutting. You'd be like, okay, that was really nice to meet you. I'm going to get a new brain surgeon. I think if a novelist tells you that, you should go get a new novelist. I do spend a lot of time making things up before I start to write. I think about things for sometimes years, and certainly with Patron Saint of Liars, I was working as a waitress at a Friday's, and I had to roll the silverware, and I had to marry the ketchup, and I would, to amuse myself, make up the story. But, You know, I did it regularly and methodically, and it didn't come to me in a burst of light. Yes. How convenient. You're right there.
Should I hold it? I thought I'd be nice to her. I was wondering about the decision to write about people that you do know and love and how that was different for you in writing Truth and Beauty.
Writing Truth and Beauty was great. And people always say to me, oh, that must have been so hard. It was the best book I ever wrote for many different reasons. One, I started it 3 weeks after Lucy died. And a lot of the reason was after 3 weeks, I'm sure that you have all had this experience, or I hope none of you have had this experience, the phone would ring. And people that I loved, who I was close to, would say to me, hey, you sound better today. Are you feeling better today? Your voice sounds a lot better today. And I would think, note to self, be sure not to sound better when you pick up the phone, because I am not better. And everyone was like, oh, it's really sad, but time to get over it. You know, kind of, people don't want you to be sad. You know, buck up. Come on, move on. Let's not talk about it anymore. Enough's enough. So I thought, okay, I'm going to write this book. And what that did was it gave me time. I wrote the book in bed. I put my computer on a cookie sheet, put all of her letters and pictures all over the bed, and I wrote this book. And I stayed with her. I stayed and I thought about her and about us exactly as long as I needed to. And that was such an enormous gift. I really do feel like I should go out and give grief seminars all over the country, because people don't get that kind of time to work through and to get all the way through to the sadness, to the joy of it, to the feeling like, I remember her dancing. I remember when we did this, it was so funny. And that I wake up from dreams about her and I feel fantastic. And the other thing that I have that I imagine you don't have is that normally when we lose someone, nobody comes to us 20 years after our mother's death and says, how are you feeling about your mom? You know, do you think about her? Do you miss her? Tell me a story about your mom. Because we don't, after 3 weeks, we don't talk about it anymore. You don't ever bring it up randomly in the middle of someone's day. You know that person you love so much who's dead? How do you think about them now? I'm one of my best friends at home, Judy's mom, died before we met. And I have to remind myself every now and then when we're out to lunch to say, you know, how do you think your mom would feel about this? How do you think your mom would, she would be so excited to see what your kids are doing now, to see what you're doing with your life. And my friend is always so happy to have the chance to talk about her mom. I have created a world in which everywhere I go, somebody says, tell me something about Lucy. You know, I really want to talk about Lucy. How do you think about her now? How do you feel about her? It's such an incredible gift. It was also really great because all of the horrible things about writing a novel, where does it start? Where does it end? Who are the characters? What is the conflict? Who's the narrator? Where's the action? What's the setting? What's the time frame? All of those things were answered in that book. Begins the day Lucy and I meet, takes place in the moments that we are together. It ends the day she dies. So structurally, it was no problem. I don't have any problem writing. I have a lot of problem putting something together. That's really hard. And so all of that was good. I do not enjoy writing about real people and living people, dead people, fine. Living people are such a pain in the neck. And I hope I never have to do it again, because there was just a lot of grief. You know, there were certain of her friends that I didn't put in the book, and they were hurt. And there were people, you know, I hate that. I don't want that. I like fiction. So I hope I do that. Go out, get a cup of ice, chew on it. I'll see you outside. You've been lovely. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, Information is available at freelibrary.org.